This is the Medicast, March 4th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis!
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 107. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this week's podcast. Here it is, March, and it's just moving along through the year so quickly. I can't wait until the full onset of spring because that means I will be that much closer to finishing nursing school. Oh my goodness, I want to scream sometimes. And you may have noticed that I've probably been a little busy because I have not hardly done any blogging, and there has been no Medicast news midweek for the last several weeks. And I want to apologize for that. I'm going to work on getting caught up on some of those things and make sure I can continue to present good information to you. My time has not entirely been taken up by my studies as a nursing student, and that is because I've been working hard on some extra things that I'm going to be presenting to you, the Medicast audience, here coming up in just maybe as little as a week. And I'm hoping to talk more about that maybe in a future episode, maybe next week or during the Medicast Live coming up on March 11th. And I hope to have some more information to present to you, but some really exciting things going on, some extra items for those of you that might be interested in getting some more content from the Medicast, some more information from myself and some of the other podcasters and bloggers that I'm in touch with as well. So stay tuned and we'll talk more about that here soon. I'll take this opportunity to remind all of you to head over to the Medicast forums. There's really been some good discussions started over there and some great questions being asked, and you can provide your own comments and answers as well as offering your own suggestions for show topics, for things that you'd like to get your questions answered. It's a great way for the Medicast community to share and help each other out. And you can do that at forums.medicast.com. And you can register for free over there and get right on in. You can share your photos, share your videos all over at the Medicast forums. And it's a great opportunity for everyone to participate in this community. Let's jump into the listener email, and I want to lead off by saying hi to a good friend of mine, Jeff. He's down in Baltimore, and he just recently signed up for the Medicast newsletter. He found the site, and I was talking to him, and he got to take a look at it and listen to the show. And so, Jeff, I want to welcome you officially to the Medicast, and it's great to have you checking in. Make sure you and everyone else that you know down there in Baltimore stays in touch and keeps me straight and narrow here as far as Maryland protocols go when I do happen to mention them. I also want to thank listener Ross, who sent an email to me regarding the use of medical equipment on board an aircraft and what equipment we might likely find on board an airliner if we were traveling and were called upon to assist in an emergency. And that's a topic I covered in a previous episode about a year or so ago, and Ross remembered that and sent me a link. So I'll have a link to that up on the blog sometime this week. You can check over there at medicast.com at the Medicast blog, and you'll find that link when I get that posted up. Probably, I would say, Wednesday evening would be a good time to check for that. Got an email from listener Joe, who wanted to let me know that where he works, they do educational podcasting as well for the students, and he wanted to let him know that at their medic program, he's going to have their students start getting the Medicast. So, Joe, thank you very much for sending me that email, and I certainly look forward to talking directly to your students there, and if they have any questions or you have any more comments or questions you'd like to pose, please make sure you send them in here to me at the Medicast at podmedic@mac.com. I got an email also from listener Scott from London, Canada, and he says that in his signature, London, the one in Canada, and he had some interesting comments he wanted to pose as well. One of them had to do with Glasgow coma scores and that it was important to ascertain a baseline for the patient prior to our arrival. If we have a patient that is normally diminished in some way, that our GCS would not necessarily be accurate because we would have them being decreased from a 15 where their baseline would normally be maybe a 13 or a 14 if for some reason they were altered already. And, you know, Scott, that makes you make a great point. And I would say that that's part of your history taking and you need to ascertain if the patient has any other medical problems and mental deficiencies or prior brain injury or dementia would all come into play there. The other side of this is whenever you have a patient and you have something like GCS or a vital sign, you can't just take it as a single picture. In other words, you need to look at the slideshow, if you will, if you're looking at pictures, right? You know, you can see one picture and it looks like one thing, and that doesn't have anything to do because GCS, vital signs, they're all about the trending. Where is the patient headed? And this is why we go back and look at mental status again during our reassessment of a patient. We go back and we take regular vital signs on a regular basis to make sure that these patients are trended. It doesn't mean anything if you say to me that the patient is stable and has a single set of vital signs. What you need to say is, I have a stable patient and the vital signs are 120 over 80, respirations of 16, and a pulse of 70, and they have remained within that range for the last two sets of vitals. That tells me that you have a stable patient, but it means nothing to me if you tell me that. Let's say that that patient has been hypertensive and all of a sudden has a precipitous drop in their blood pressure and starts exhibiting relative bradycardia. That is an indication that something else might be going on. So again, thank you very much, Scott, for that and your other comments as well. And I appreciate everything that you sent in. I also heard this week from a friend of mine, James. James and I have been working on a project outside of the MedicCast, and I'd been doing some writing for them. And he's no longer affiliated. That project is now defunct. And he was just checking in with me over at my Facebook page and wanted to say hi. So, James, how are you? It's great to hear from you. And we'll have to catch up and talk some, and maybe we can bring you in here to help out with the MedicCast. And if the rest of you don't already check up with me over at Facebook. If you have a Facebook page, you can do so. I am listed there as the PodMedic or PodMedic at Facebook. And if you don't already have a Facebook page, you might want to check it out. It's just another social network that has applications you can apply to your front page. Great ways to share some time with people, keep up with what folks are doing, and it's a great way to just generally keep in touch. So if you haven't checked that out, you might want to do so. The link of the week this week? Well, the link of the week this week is going to be the MedicCast Live. That's right, it's that time of the month again, folks, and that means that it's going to be the MedicCast Live coming up on Tuesday, March 11th. Now, it's a little over a week away from when I record this, but I've found that if I announce it 2 weeks ahead of time that I get a better response from the listeners because you guys tend to listen to the show spread out across the course of the week. So it'll actually be closer than you think. And that's going to be Tuesday night, March 11th at 10 p.m. Eastern time, an opportunity for you to listen live via web streaming, share with us in the chat room live on that web stream, or you can call in directly to the phone number live, and that phone number is listed over there at the site. So you don't call into the normal MedicCast voicemail line, you'll actually call into the special MedicCast Live line, and you can find out more about that over at talkshoe.com, or you can go directly to MedicCastLive.com. And registration is free. You're good to go when you get in there, and I'm going to look forward to hearing from you. Now, the topic this month, I think this is going to be a great topic for many of you, and this is EMS education. What are we looking for in a good EMS student? And I mean from the very first responder BLS level all the way up to continuing education, critical care, whatever it is you're talking about. I want to know what you have done to succeed in the past. So this is a great opportunity for people who have been successful students to come and share their knowledge, share their expertise, share their tricks for studying and working at the same time, all of those things. Or if you're a student right now, ask questions about what works for other people or share what's been working for you. All of these things can be done over at the MedicCast Live in just a little over a week, and I'm really looking forward to that. Hopefully, Rick Rosati will be able to join us. Rick has been sick. If you've checked out the Mitigation Journal podcast, you know that Rick hasn't put a new episode up in a couple of weeks, and that is because he has been just dying. I mean, he has had a major bout with a respiratory flu, and he has not been able to even, he can't complete a sentence without coughing. I talked to him on the phone the other night, and he was just having trouble even completing a single sentence. So he has gone to see his physician and trying to get that taken care of. And hopefully, Rick, I'm hoping you're feeling better, buddy. But we want to have you here on the MedicCast Live along with our other esteemed panelists. When they show up, I'll know who they are. I have several bloggers and podcasters that check in with the show regularly. And so hopefully we'll have a good representation from them as well. And I'm looking forward to hearing from you. As always, any listener that checks into the show, listen carefully. I'll give you a code that you can put in the subject line of your email to me within the following 24 hours after that podcast. And if you do so, you will be entered in a drawing for a free MedicCast t-shirt. So you just need to check in, listen to the show live that night. You can do it even, you can even do it if you're not near a computer. You can call in on your cell phone. So if you have free nights and weekends, you can get the phone number and the TalkCast ID ahead of time, and you can call in directly and listen live via your cell phone. A great way to listen to the show. All can be done over at MedicCastLive.com. So check it out. Registration is free, so you get a free username and an ID, and you'll be good to go for next week's episode of the MedicCast Live. Time now to jump on into this week's news. And this first item, I think, is a problem that many areas of the country, depending on their proximity to resort areas, are going to be dealing with. If they haven't already started dealing with it, they'll be dealing with it soon. This has to do with some beachfront areas along the Atlantic coast. Specifically, this particular article comes out of Delaware. And Sussex County, Delaware, lies right along the coast and has many beautiful beaches. My family has been to some of their state park beaches down there. They're really good public beaches. But when you're a paramedic or a police officer or a firefighter, a teacher that's in that region, up until recently, it was okay as far as home costs went because you could still purchase a home for a relatively reasonable amount just off the beach or back inland a little ways. But that is no longer the case. In fact, homes that were going for $200,000 a few years ago are now approaching $700,000 or $1 million for these homes as retirees flock to the beach near areas, not the beachfront, but near the beach, and are buying up homes in these developments for vacation homes. And so people that work in public safety, people that work in any kind of public job that doesn't make ridiculous amounts of money are having trouble finding places to live, and in fact are having to look at buying homes as much as an hour away. With gas prices the way they are, that's just unreasonable. I'm sure this is a problem that is being faced by many areas of the country. I'd urge you to check out the link in the show notes. They talk about the Florida Keys, about Hawaii, and other areas of the country. But I'll tell you, this is a problem that is going to have to be resolved by localities. They're going to have to find some way to subsidize the housing for people in their communities if they want to maintain people to do those service, important public service jobs in those communities. They're going to have to start either paying a wage that will allow them to live there, or they're going to have to find some way to subsidize their housing costs. And this is an issue that they're going to really have to take a good, long, hard look at, or they're not going to be able to resolve this problem. And they're going to be unable to find anyone to perform these vital public safety jobs in their communities. And I suspect that the price of these homes will go down rapidly if a few of them burn down without any fire coverage, or a few people die because they don't have EMS coverage because they can't get anybody to afford to live in the nearby communities. Moving right along, I want to look at a story that I found having to do with the Virginia Tech shootings of about a year ago, happened about April 2007. And this was because of a story I found in the Cumberland Times News out in Western Maryland. And in that article, this gentleman by the name of Colin Whitmore was a lieutenant with the Virginia Tech EMS service, and he was the EMS command officer, or one of them, on the scene. And I've talked about this and other issues involving multiple shootings and dealing with mass casualty incidents and triage. And yet, interestingly enough, Colin Whitmore has something different to talk about with regard to this particular issue. He talks about dealing with patients who have behavioral issues and the prevailing thought process that goes through a lot of EMS providers' minds when they handle patients that have a behavioral problem. Psych patients tend to be looked down upon. Psych patients are not necessarily treated well, and we don't take psych patients seriously. You know, we get somebody that's threatened suicide or taken too many pills, and we drop them off and we call them an idiot and we head on our way. And I have to agree with this 100%. And anybody who's listened to the Medicast for any length of time knows that I really have an issue with people not handling patients appropriately. And this is no different than if you were to improperly splint or handle a broken extremity, right? You know, if you have to go and deal with a bent elbow injury and you just decide to just pull on that arm and not handle it like a fragile, very painful injury, that, you know, you would be bounced out of your service. You wouldn't pass EMT if you did that. You wouldn't pass paramedic if you did that. I don't care what you did. That would be completely inappropriate treatment. And yet we joke and make fun of psych patients all the time. What's the difference? I mean, I'm serious. What's the difference between grabbing someone who has a broken arm by their broken extremity and hauling them into the stretcher and laughing at a psych patient that just tried to kill themselves? I would say to you that there is no difference. I would say that the way you treat a psych patient should be thought through and handled in much the similar way you deal with any medical problem. These patients often are dealing with a very real chemical problem, a chemical imbalance that, when dealt with appropriately and assisted with some therapy, can get back on their feet and be as normal as you or I. And I would say that, you know, you better be careful, because we deal with a lot of strange situations, a lot of stress, a lot of things that everyone else doesn't get to see, and there but for the grace of God would go any of us. So I think the next time you have a psych patient, you ought to think a little bit about how you deal with them. You ought to deal with them with respect. You ought to deal with them in such a way that you learn from the experience and that you're better able and prepared to help psych patients get the help that they need. They are no different than any other patient. They deserve to go to the best appropriate center. They deserve to have care handed off at the hospital without any snide remarks. And they deserve to be treated like human beings. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox. Let's move into the third story tonight, and this has to do with something I think we all could learn something from, and that has to do with fatigue. If you're like most of the providers I know, you're working two jobs, you're working one and a half jobs, you're working some combination that is leaving you all kinds of strung out and tired. And one of the things that we deal with a lot is just general fatigue. You know, we work all day and then we work all night and then we come home and sleep for a few hours and we get up and go to another job. And these are all things that many people deal with. How do we deal with that appropriately? I found a great article over at WebMD.com that looks at just this, talking about dealing with fatigue and being too tired to exercise. This is a study out of the University of Georgia where they looked at a group of young adults who said they were tired all the time. They took these group of young adults and took some of them and actually got them involved in a mild exercise program. Wait, so he said exercise. I hear people running from the room. No, mild exercise. What is mild exercise? 3 sessions per week, pedaling a stationary bicycle at a mild pace. Okay, we're talking like 3 half-hour workout sessions that were mild workout sessions. This means you could probably get the same by like walking around the block for 15 minutes a couple times a day, 3 times a week, right? What these researchers found was that the people that were involved in mild exercise, when compared to those that did moderate exercise and those that did no exercise, had the biggest improvement in their energy levels. These people felt more energetic and were more able to, they felt, deal with things that they came through throughout their day. Now, this means that a relatively mild or low moderate amount of exercise can have a huge amount of improvement on your life. So the next time you say, hey, I'm just too tired to exercise or I have no energy, get yourself up and do 20 minutes of running around, maybe 20 minutes of a brisk walk. Just get out there and just do something to get your blood pumping. And you may be surprised to find that after doing that for a week or so, that you actually have more energy and aren't as fatigued. Finally, in my last story this week, I'm going to look at an interesting story about the smallpox vaccine. Now, smallpox has been eradicated in the world. It's one of the big, I'd say, major world health achievements of the 20th century. And it just shows what can happen when governments cooperate and work together to have a positive effect on the health of the world community. So the United States government and the Centers for Disease Control recently announced that they are going to dispose of the last of the 12 million doses of Dryvax, the oldest version of the smallpox vaccine. Now they are keeping more modern products and stockpiled of these modern manufactured laboratory versions of the vaccine. But this original vaccine, the Dryvax, was actually produced by scraping virus off the skin of infected calves. And so, you know, this was an old-fashioned way of doing things. And because it was important to keep a sufficient stockpiles of the viral or the antiviral vaccine around, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control had maintained an additional 12 million doses of this old version of the vaccine, and they're getting rid of it. They say that there's not necessarily as much need for it, and because this is a time when we can move forward into better production techniques and have better stockpiles on hand. But this is the oldest vaccine. It is the vaccine that was used to eliminate smallpox in the United States. So just interesting to check on and just kind of an interesting side note for medical history. I think it's pretty cool. And it's something that I'd like to see more of. I'd like to see more major diseases eradicated like this. So anyway, that's a look at the news this week. And I guess it means it's going to be time now to move on into the tip and trick of the week. For the tip and trick of the week this week, I'm going to be looking at hypoxia. We're going to kind of do a little bit of return to basics this week and look at some information that for some of us is going to be a review and for others of us is going to be a much needed extra piece of information as they move on into their studies. Hypoxia is something that we deal with quite frequently, so much so that I think for experienced providers, we do it automatically. We put patients on oxygen. We get a general sense from looking at somebody when they're in distress and just go into action. And that's something that comes with experience, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't understand what's going on with patients who are hypoxic. So what are some of the causes of hypoxia? Well, first of all, I think it's important that we actually determine what it is that we're talking about with hypoxia. I looked in my trusty Tabor's medical dictionary and found some definitions. Hypoxia is technically an oxygen deficiency in body tissues, a decreased concentration of oxygen in the inspired air. Now, that's two different things. Hypoxia at the tissue level is going to be not getting enough oxygen for some reason. Some transport mechanism or something is keeping oxygen from leaving the blood, or there's not enough oxygen in the blood or being carried by the hemoglobin in the blood to the tissues, and therefore they are deficient of the oxygen that they need. That's different from the decreased oxygen concentration in the inspired air, and that would be hypoxia at the ventilation level or at the respiratory level, where there is actually not enough oxygen to get enough oxygen transferred across into the lungs barriers and at the alveoli into the capillaries there to move into the rest of the body's tissues. There are some other terms we need to keep track of. Sometimes you might hear the term anoxia, A-N-O-X-I-A, anoxia. Anoxia is technically meaning the absence of oxygen. And this is sometimes used mistakenly as interchangeable with hypoxia. Hypo means lower than or too low. Hypo means low oxygen. Anoxia means no oxygen. And the problem is, of course, if there's no oxygen, that's a whole nother problem. You might find a situation where there's anoxia in, say, an environment where all of the oxygen's been consumed by a fire in a sealed building where the oxygen's been removed from that method. And that's going to cause anoxia or no oxygen. Hypoxemia is another term we need to understand, and that specifically refers to the lowered amount of oxygen dissolved in the blood, maintained as either dissolved oxygen gas in the blood or being carried by the blood on the hemoglobin molecules. And so those are the three things you need to kind of keep in mind while we talk about hypoxia here over the next few minutes. The first thing we're going to do is assess our patients to find out if they do have hypoxia. And so some of the things that we might see that would cause us to think that they are hypoxic are signs, first of all, of respiratory distress. Are they seeming to have trouble difficulty breathing? Are they cyanotic? Do they have that blue or gray tinge around their lips or in their nail beds? Or, if in dark-skinned people, anywhere that they have pink mucous membranes, you may see bluing there. Also, are they unable to speak clearly in complete sentences? Are they unable to answer you without stopping to take a breath? One word answers, and then a breath, and then another word, and then a breath. That's a sign that this person is unable to get enough air for whatever reason. They may be hypoxic because of this, or they may be hyperventilating, but at least you can start heading down a path. They may also be positioning themselves to try to gain better ventilatory access to their system. And that will be by tripoding, what's called tripoding. This is where they sit up nice and straight and they lean forward a little bit and they prop themselves up on their arms. And what that does is it allows the rib cage to fully expand, lets gravity help them out a little bit by pulling the rib cage out and forward. They lean over a little bit and they push up with their arms so that their shoulders are nice and high, and they create the biggest possible space in their chest cavity to allow for the access of oxygen and air to rush in and perfuse their lung tissues. You may also have some tools to assess relative hypoxia. And again, I say tools are there to be used and understood, but they are not to be the sole means that we use for judgment. And I say that caution because we're going to talk about pulse ox here. And pulse ox is one of those tools that gives us a sense of something that might be going on, but it's not a definitive tool. We need to treat the patient and not the monitoring device. In this situation, though, it may be an indication when coupled with other signs of distress of a respiratory nature that they have something going on and are indeed hypoxic. So if you have a pulse ox that gets down below, say, 95, you're down in 91, 94 range, that's going to be mildly hypoxic. Below 91 down to 85 or so is going to be moderately hypoxic. And anything 85 and below, I would consider severely hypoxic. So you can use your pulse ox as an assessment tool as well. So once you've determined the patient's hypoxic by whatever means that you do so, what do you do now? All right, we should all be able to do this one, right? I don't care what level of care you are. What's the first thing you do when you have a patient in respiratory distress? Put them on oxygen. If they're hypoxic at all and you think that they're having trouble breathing, go right to the non-rebreather, put it on them, give them 15 liters per minute O2, and go ahead and let that help them breathe. That's the best thing to do in my estimation. I know people say, oh no, put them on a nasal cannula first, see how they do. No, let's put them on the non-rebreather first and see how they do. And if they can't tolerate the non-rebreather for some reason, or they seem to be doing better, then we can back down to the nasal cannula. And I tend to be a both barrels kind of guy. We'll talk about oxygen in the next segment. So you've done this. You've started to treat their problem. Now we need to do the next step. And the next step is find out what's causing their hypoxia. Let's think a little bit about hypoxia, okay? Hypoxia is, again, decreased levels of oxygen at the tissue level or decreased level of oxygen in the lungs. So it can be really only a couple of different things that can be causing hypoxia in these patients, at least in general. There can be a problem with too little oxygen in the surrounding environment for whatever reason. Remember, this could be as a result of patients that are not used to high altitude. Some of you practice EMS in mountainous regions, places like Denver, Jackson, Colorado. Many of those different high altitude regions are going to be dealing with patients who maybe traveled up recently from areas where they're used to sea level oxygen pressures. And so moving into a higher altitude where the partial pressure of oxygen in the normal air is not what they're used to can cause someone to become hypoxic, especially if they've recently exerted themselves. So that can be part of the problem. Again, were they in an environment that was sealed off for some reason and the oxygen was used up or replaced by a heavier gas? Carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide all could cause problems and cause them to become hypoxic. Carbon monoxide leads us to another part of the problem, but we'll get to that at the third stage here. The next stage would be if there's not a problem with the amount of oxygen in the air that they're bringing in, then is there a problem between the oxygen and the lung tissue and the bloodstream? In other words, is there an underlying lung disease like COPD where they are unable to effectively ventilate themselves or they're unable to perfuse that oxygen across into the bloodstream and get the carbon dioxide back out again? So that's one and two. There's either not enough oxygen in the air. Number two would be there's not a clear way for the oxygen to get across the barrier in the lungs to get into the bloodstream because of an injury, because of an underlying pulmonary disease, because of something like a tension pneumothorax. These are all things that you can start thinking about. History of COPD, chronic bronchitis, emphysema, asthma, all are lung-related problems that are going to cause a ventilation-perfusion mismatch. Pulmonary embolism is another one. We could just keep going here. Anything that causes injury to the lungs or causes the lungs to be unable to perform their function to their best ability is going to cause an issue here. Now we get into the tissue perfusion level. What keeps oxygen from getting to the tissues? If we can get oxygen into the blood, what causes us problems at the tissue level? Well, this is where we're talking about problems in the body chemistry. Problems in the electrolyte levels may cause issues. Extreme acidosis or alkalosis will start to cause breakdown in metabolic function and poisonings. So things like carbon monoxide, Carbon monoxide has 100 times greater affinity for hemoglobin than oxygen does. If there's carbon monoxide at too high a level in the lungs, it will latch onto the hemoglobin and push the oxygen off. And that means that the hemoglobin will go by, it'll look nice and red, but the oxygen will not be able to come off because there isn't any oxygen there, and the body's tissues will be starved for oxygen. That can happen very quickly in a situation of carbon monoxide poisoning. So again, good history taking, good understanding of what goes on, high flow O2, treat the patient appropriately. Especially in the case of poisonings, it's very important to get a good history. If you have a situation where a patient is hypoxic and you can't figure out why, you don't think they were in an oxygen-starved environment, they don't have any history of underlying lung problems or recent chest injury that might cause a contusion to their lung or signs of a collapsed lung, they have breath sounds in all fields, maybe they have a pulmonary embolism, you're not sure, you have to go with your gut, but you do need to take a good history and make sure that you pass that history on to the emergency department. This patient could crash at any time, and we need to take the history that we can get in the field because they may not be able to get such a good history later on. So that's a look at hypoxia. Let's move on into the med of the week and talk about oxygen. So what about oxygen? What are we talking about when we talk about the drug oxygen? Yes, oxygen is a drug, and we need to remember that because there are some things we can do with oxygen that are bad. There aren't too many because oxygen is so vital to us that we very readily handle too much oxygen in most situations. But it's important to understand how to appropriately deliver oxygen and how not to deliver oxygen. First of all, oxygen is indicated for any patient, both trauma and medical. These patients can use oxygen more effectively to deal with their problems. The body can take care of itself a lot better than we can in most cases. So we can do a lot to help the body be more efficient by making sure it is properly oxygenated. Does this mean we need to like pump them full of 100% O2 all the time? Not necessarily, but I am a proponent of going higher than lower in this situation. There are no studies and no evidence that high flow O2 for relatively short periods of time has any negative effect on patients that have a history of respiratory illness, patients with COPD. You often hear about these patients using the hypoxic drive and dealing with their ongoing systemic hypoxia to drive their respiratory rate. And if we give them oxygen for too long, it'll make them stop breathing. Well, that's just not true. And if it is true, it doesn't happen for days. I mean, this person would have to be on a non-rebreather mask 24 hours a day for days before we would see any significant effect on their respiratory rate. Doesn't mean we do that, but it does mean that we can put them on oxygen at high flow in the back of our ambulance and be just fine for any kind of reasonable transport time. We'll run out of oxygen before they run out of respirations to go with it. So that's one side of the picture of oxygen delivery. So based on the delivery device you have available, that will determine the flow of oxygen that you deliver to the patient. You're going to administer based on the type of mask or nasal cannula or whatever you're using. Nasal cannulas, simple face masks or partial rebreather face masks, non-rebreather face masks, and bag valve masks are the most common things you're likely to see in the field. I know in our units we have nasal cannulas, non-rebreathers, and bag valve masks. Really simple. Nasal cannulas, 2 to 6 liters per minute. Partial rebreathers, simple face masks are looking at about 6 to 10 liters per minute, and then your non-rebreathers and your bag valve masks, turn them up all the way, 12 to 15 liters per minute. Now, why the range? Well, you know, here's my look at that. I just turn them up. If it's 2 to 6 liters per minute for the nasal cannula, you can experience drying in the nasal passages, so start them at 2 liters or start them at 4 liters. If you need to go to 6 liters a minute on the nasal cannula, unless they just cannot tolerate the face mask, put them up to the face mask. Put them on 12 liters on a non-rebreather, or put them on 10 liters on a simple face mask, and just jump right to the next level. Because they will get uncomfortable from a nasal cannula, blowing that cool, dry air, the oxygen up into their nasal passages will dry them out and make them uncomfortable. So that's something to consider if you're running higher, the higher end of nasal cannula O2. The face masks aren't so bad because it's collecting in the face masks before they draw it in, but those nasal cannulas can be a little irritating at times. You're going to want to monitor the patients carefully. You're going to want to assess them carefully. And believe me, you do not want to have a patient on a non-rebreather and then not pay attention and realize your oxygen ran out. You will make them hypoxic. A non-rebreather is built to make sure that they don't rebreathe air from the outside, that they don't draw back in their carbon dioxide. It gives them the highest level of oxygenation via our oxygen tanks. And the problem, of course, with that is if you run out of oxygen coming in through the tubing and it's fitted properly to their face, they're going to not be able to draw in much air because there's nothing coming in and they're drawing in around the edges and they're not going to be very comfortable. So you do need to monitor your patients, constantly reassess, and see what the effects of the medication, in this case oxygen, is on your patient. What is it doing? Are you having a positive effect? Did their pulse ox come up? Are they more alert? Are they reporting less distress? Do they seem like they're able to breathe again? These are all signs that your medication, your oxygen, is having a good effect. And it's one of those things that I find we take for granted, but it is such a simple intervention and such a simple thing to do for our patients to just administer them a little oxygen. And that's this week's Med of the Week. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show, and I hope you were able to get some helpful review from another look at hypoxia and a look at the drug oxygen. If you'd like to check out the links to anything I talked about in this show, you can head over to MedicCast.com, and over there you'll find the MedicCast blog, link to the MedicCast page, and you can just click on that, head over to the MedicCast blog, and find the show notes for this and every other episode of the show, as well as links to all of the other articles that I post throughout the week as I find other studies and news to talk about. You'll also be able to get in touch with me directly by email at podmedic@mac.com. Please, please get back in touch with me. Let me know what you thought of this show. Let me know what you want to hear in another show. And perhaps even if I've made a mistake, correct me. Let me know if I made any errors so I can make sure that the community of the MedicCast listeners gets the best possible information that they can. Also, you can reach me via the MedicCast voicemail line at 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. If you haven't already done so, I urge you to go over and check out the MedicCast forums at forums.mediccast.com. If you don't want to email me, but you'd still have a question that you'd like to get answered, go over there, register completely for free, and go ahead and post your question over at the MedicCast forums. There's a great group of people, a great community building over there, and it's an opportunity for all of us to share our knowledge and our questions with each other. I will close out, as I always do, with some excellent PodSafe music. And this week, I'm really happy. I found a great song over at the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. This song is by an artist by the name of Ingrid Michaelson. Ingrid has a great song called The Way I Am. I really like it a lot, and I hope you do as well. If you do, check out her link in the show notes. It'll take you directly to her page over at the PodSafe Music Network, and you can contact her and let her know you heard it here on the MedicCast. You can also find a link to the iTunes store if you'd like to purchase her music, a great way to support this artist. All right, that's it for me. I will wrap up, as I always do, by saying, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.
Then I would catch you. You need a make.